A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I've got to say, it's a question that probably resonates with a lot of people who've navigated an ADHD diagnosis later in life. He's asking about the actual neurochemical difference between caffeine and prescription ADHD medications. His experience was that he spent years self-medicating with aggressive amounts of coffee, skeptical that a small tablet could outperform liters of the stuff. He wants to know why ADHD meds feel cleaner, even if they're not perfect, and what's happening at the receptor level that makes caffeine such a dirty substitute. This is one of those questions where the subjective experience maps onto the pharmacology pretty neatly.
It really does. And Daniel's description of caffeine as a dirty drug for ADHD is spot on, even from a purely biochemical standpoint. Before we get into it, fun fact, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Hopefully, it had its coffee first. So where do we even start with this? Because I think most people assume caffeine and ADHD meds are doing roughly the same thing, just at different intensities.
That assumption is exactly what makes this worth unpacking. The difference isn't one of degree, it's one of mechanism. Caffeine and prescription stimulants operate on entirely different neurotransmitter systems. Caffeine's primary mechanism is adenosine receptor antagonism. Adenosine is a neuromodulator that builds up in the brain throughout the day, creating sleep pressure. Caffeine works by blocking adenosine receptors, specifically the A1 and A2A subtypes. It doesn't actually give you energy, it just prevents your brain from registering how tired it is.
It's less like fuel and more like putting tape over the low fuel warning light.
That's a genuinely useful way to think about it. And that's the first major distinction. ADHD medications, whether we're talking about methylphenidate or amphetamine-based drugs, work primarily on the dopamine and norepinephrine systems. They either block the reuptake of those neurotransmitters or trigger their release directly. Caffeine has only weak, indirect effects on dopamine. It does increase dopamine signaling slightly in the striatum, but it does this through adenosine-dopamine receptor interactions, not by directly targeting dopamine transporters. The effect is modest and inconsistent.
When Daniel says coffee gives him some kind of focus, but it's dirty, part of what he's describing is that adenosine blockade is a blunt instrument. You're not actually addressing the dopamine deficiency that's core to ADHD, you're just jamming the tiredness signal.
And there's a cascade of downstream effects that make it even messier. Adenosine receptors are everywhere in the body, not just in the brain. They're in the heart, the blood vessels, the kidneys, the gastrointestinal tract. When you block adenosine systemically, you get vasoconstriction, increased heart rate, diuretic effects, and smooth muscle changes in the gut. That's why Daniel mentions digestive issues. Adenosine normally helps regulate gut motility and secretion. Block it, and things get unpredictable.
I've always found it interesting that coffee specifically seems to have a pronounced laxative effect that isn't fully explained by caffeine alone. There's something in the brew itself.
Decaffeinated coffee can still stimulate colonic activity in some people, which suggests other compounds in coffee, like chlorogenic acids, play a role. But the caffeine component definitely contributes. The point is, the physical side effects Daniel describes aren't incidental, they're intrinsic to the mechanism. Caffeine can't be selective about where it blocks adenosine. It hits every adenosine receptor it can reach.
Whereas prescription stimulants are designed to be more selective. Methylphenidate, for example, is a dopamine and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It binds to the dopamine transporter and the norepinephrine transporter, blocking them so that these neurotransmitters stay in the synaptic cleft longer. That's a targeted intervention.
And the dopamine transporter is particularly dense in the striatum and prefrontal cortex, areas directly implicated in ADHD. The prefrontal cortex is where executive function lives, working memory, impulse control, attention regulation. In ADHD, there's insufficient dopamine signaling in these circuits. Methylphenidate increases that signaling where it's needed, Caffeine doesn't have that anatomical specificity. It's blocking adenosine receptors wherever they happen to be.
Let me push on something. Daniel mentions that ADHD meds still have physical effects, and that sometimes they hit too hard and don't last long enough. That's not just a subjective complaint. That's a formulation issue, right?
It is, and it's one of the major challenges in ADHD pharmacotherapy. The pharmacokinetics matter enormously. Immediate-release formulations produce a rapid rise in plasma concentration, which can feel like a jolt, followed by a relatively quick decline. That peak and trough pattern is what Daniel is describing. Extended-release formulations smooth this out using various delivery mechanisms: osmotic pumps, coated beads that dissolve at different rates, prodrugs that require enzymatic conversion. Lisdexamfetamine, for instance, is a prodrug that's inactive until it's cleaved in the bloodstream, which inherently limits how fast it can take effect.
That's something coffee drinkers manage intuitively. People titrate their caffeine intake across the day with multiple cups, maintaining a rough steady state. It's a crude pharmacokinetic strategy, but it works after a fashion.
It does, until it doesn't. The half-life of caffeine is about 3 to 7 hours in most adults, but it varies enormously based on genetics, liver function, whether someone smokes, whether they're pregnant. If you're a slow metabolizer and you're drinking coffee at 4 in the afternoon, you're still adenosine blocked at midnight. That's where the sleep disruption comes in, which is particularly cruel for ADHD. Poor sleep worsens executive function, which increases the perceived need for caffeine the next day. It's a vicious cycle.
I want to go back to something you said about dopamine. The dopamine deficiency hypothesis of ADHD is well established, but it's not the whole story. Norepinephrine matters too, and I think that's another place where caffeine falls short.
It absolutely does. Norepinephrine is critical for alertness and sustained attention, particularly under conditions that require effortful focus. ADHD medications boost norepinephrine signaling alongside dopamine. Caffeine does increase norepinephrine release indirectly through adenosine blockade, but again, it's non-selective. You get systemic sympathetic activation, the jitters, the racing heart, without the targeted cognitive benefit.
You're getting the peripheral fight-or-flight response without the prefrontal tuning. That's a terrible trade-off.
It's exactly what Daniel is describing when he talks about physical effects. The sympathetic activation from caffeine is broad and undifferentiated. Your heart pounds, your hands might shake, you feel wired. With properly dosed ADHD medication, the cognitive effects are more pronounced than the peripheral effects, at least ideally. It's not perfect, and individual responses vary, but the therapeutic window is designed to favor central over peripheral action.
Let's talk about the stigma angle Daniel raised. People say to him, "Why don't you just drink coffee? It's more normal." There's a cultural blind spot there. Caffeine is so normalized that people forget it's a psychoactive drug with a dependence syndrome.
Caffeine use disorder is recognized in the DSM-5 as a condition for further study, and withdrawal is an official diagnosis. The symptoms include headache, fatigue, dysphoric mood, difficulty concentrating, and flu-like symptoms. It's a real physiological dependence. The difference is social framing. Coffee is associated with productivity, social ritual, morning routines. Amphetamine is associated with abuse, even though at therapeutic doses for ADHD, the risk of addiction is actually lower than for untreated ADHD, where people are at higher risk for substance use disorders generally.
There's solid epidemiological evidence for that, right? Treating ADHD with stimulants reduces the risk of subsequent substance abuse.
Multiple longitudinal studies support that. A meta-analysis found that ADHD medication was associated with a significant reduction in later substance use disorders. The protective effect is thought to come from improved impulse control and reduced self-medication behavior. Daniel's story is a perfect illustration. He was self-medicating with caffeine because it was the available tool. Once he had access to a more targeted intervention, he didn't need to.
I think that's the part that doesn't get enough attention. The self-medication hypothesis of addiction applies to caffeine as much as to any other substance. People with undiagnosed ADHD are drawn to stimulants because their brains are seeking dopamine. Caffeine is legal, cheap, and socially encouraged. It's the most accessible stimulant on the planet.
It's not just caffeine. There's a well-documented association between ADHD and higher rates of nicotine use. Nicotine is also a stimulant that increases dopamine release, and people with ADHD often report that smoking helps them focus. The same mechanism is at work. It's an attempt to correct a neurochemical deficit with whatever tools are at hand. The tragedy is that these are blunt, harmful tools compared to what's available with proper medical management.
I want to dig into the receptor level details a bit more, because I think that's where the real aha moment is. Adenosine A2A receptors form heteromers with dopamine D2 receptors in the striatum. When caffeine blocks A2A, it changes how D2 receptors respond to dopamine. Is that the indirect dopamine effect you mentioned?
Adenosine A2A and dopamine D2 receptors are colocalized on striatal medium spiny neurons, and they have antagonistic interactions. Activating A2A reduces D2 signaling. Blocking A2A with caffeine therefore disinhibits D2 signaling. It's a real effect, but it's indirect and limited to the circuits where those heteromers exist. It's not the same as increasing dopamine availability across the board or blocking reuptake. And critically, it doesn't address the D1 receptor pathways in the prefrontal cortex that are so important for working memory.
Caffeine is essentially tuning a very specific subset of dopamine signaling while also activating a whole body stress response. It's no wonder Daniel describes it as dirty.
There's another layer. Caffeine also triggers the release of calcium from intracellular stores and neurons, which can enhance neurotransmitter release non-specifically. It inhibits phosphodiesterase, though only at very high concentrations. It mobilizes intracellular calcium. These are all real pharmacological effects, but they're not coordinated toward any particular cognitive outcome. It's a pharmacological shotgun.
Whereas methylphenidate is a precision tool. It binds to the dopamine transporter and physically blocks it, preventing dopamine from being cleared from the synapse. The effect is localized to regions with high dopamine transporter density, which is exactly the circuits implicated in ADHD.
Amphetamine goes a step further. It not only blocks the dopamine transporter, it actually reverses it, causing dopamine to be pumped out of the presynaptic neuron into the synapse. It also inhibits the vesicular monoamine transporter, which increases cytoplasmic dopamine concentrations, providing more substrate for reverse transport. That's why amphetamine-based medications can feel more potent milligram for milligram.
This is where the dosing precision of pharmaceuticals becomes really important. With coffee, you're getting a variable dose of caffeine depending on the bean, the roast, the brewing method. An espresso can range from 60 to over 100 milligrams of caffeine. A drip coffee can be anywhere from 80 to 200 milligrams. You're guessing every time.
The absorption rate varies with stomach contents, with individual metabolism, with the other compounds in the coffee. Chlorogenic acids can slow caffeine absorption. Diterpenes like cafestol and caweol, present in unfiltered coffee, affect lipid metabolism. It's a complex mixture. Pharmaceutical preparations are standardized to deliver a precise dose with predictable pharmacokinetics. That predictability matters enormously when you're trying to titrate a medication for daily cognitive function.
There's also the tolerance issue. Caffeine tolerance develops rapidly because the brain upregulates adenosine receptors in response to chronic blockade. After a few weeks of regular consumption, you need more caffeine to get the same effect, and you're mainly just staving off withdrawal. Does the same thing happen with ADHD medications?
It's a different picture. Tolerance to the subjective effects of stimulant medication can develop, particularly the euphoric effects, which is actually desirable from a therapeutic standpoint. You want the cognitive benefits without the high. But the therapeutic effects on attention and impulse control tend to be more stable over time. Some patients do need dose adjustments, but it's not the same escalating spiral you see with caffeine. With chronic caffeine, you get adenosine receptor upregulation. With therapeutic stimulant use, the dopamine system adaptations are more nuanced and don't seem to produce the same degree of functional tolerance for cognitive effects.
I think that's a crucial point for people who are skeptical about ADHD medication. The fear is that it's just a more potent version of caffeine, and that you'll end up on an escalating dose, dependent and burned out. But the pharmacology doesn't support that fear. The mechanisms are different enough that the long-term trajectory is different.
There's neuroimaging evidence that supports this. PET studies show that therapeutic doses of methylphenidate produce occupancy of about 50 to 70% of dopamine transporters in the striatum. That's a substantial but not complete blockade. it leaves room for the system to still function dynamically. Caffeine, at typical dietary doses, blocks maybe 50% of adenosine A1 receptors, but again, those receptors are everywhere, so the functional impact is diffuse.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. If caffeine is so inferior, why does it help at all? Daniel says it was the only thing that would help before his diagnosis. There's something real there.
It's a fair question. Caffeine does improve vigilance and reduce fatigue, and for someone with ADHD, fatigue is a major barrier to functioning. If your prefrontal cortex is underactive, any boost to general arousal can help you push through. A 2019 analysis found that caffeine improved performance on tasks requiring sustained attention, but the effect was smaller than what's typically seen with prescription stimulants, and it came with more side effects. It's better than nothing, but the signal-to-noise ratio is poor.
Signal-to-noise is a good way to frame it. With caffeine, the signal is increased alertness, and the noise is everything else. The jitters, the gut issues, the sleep disruption, the crash. With ADHD medication, the signal-to-noise ratio is engineered to be higher. It's not perfect, as Daniel acknowledges, but it's fundamentally a cleaner intervention.
That engineering didn't happen by accident. Methylphenidate was first synthesized in 1944 and was used for decades before the dopamine transporter was even identified as its primary target. The clinical observation that it improved attention and reduced hyperactivity drove the research that eventually revealed the underlying neurochemistry. Caffeine, by contrast, has been consumed for thousands of years, and nobody was optimizing it for cognitive enhancement. It's a plant alkaloid that happens to have stimulant properties.
That historical perspective is interesting. Coffee consumption really took off in Europe during the Enlightenment, and there's an argument that it contributed to the intellectual ferment of that period by replacing alcohol as the daytime beverage of choice. People were mildly drunk all day, and then they switched to being mildly caffeinated. The cognitive effects at a population level might have been significant.
The shift from beer to coffee in the workplace coincided with the rise of modern science and commerce, but the point is, coffee was a cultural accident. Nobody sat down and said, let's design a molecule that selectively enhances prefrontal dopamine signaling. That's what pharmaceutical development did decades later.
Let's talk about the subjective experience Daniel describes. He says he was skeptical that a little tablet could do a better job than liters of coffee. That skepticism is understandable when your reference point is volume. You've been consuming a liter of liquid, feeling it in your gut, feeling the warmth, the ritual. The pill seems insubstantial by comparison.
The ritual aspect is underappreciated. Coffee drinking is a multisensory experience. The smell, the warmth, the bitterness, the act of sipping. It's deeply conditioned as a focus cue. For many people with ADHD, the ritual itself becomes part of the cognitive scaffolding. The medication lacks that sensory richness. It's just a swallow of water and then you wait. That can feel almost implausible.
There's a placebo component to the ritual. If you've spent years associating the taste and smell of coffee with the onset of focus, your brain starts to anticipate the effect. The conditioned response can be almost as powerful as the pharmacological one. When you switch to a pill, you lose that anticipatory cue.
Though the flip side is that the pharmacological effect of the pill is more reliable. The conditioned response to coffee can fail if you're tired enough or stressed enough. The medication effect is more robust because it's directly targeting the relevant circuitry. It doesn't depend on associative learning to work.
Daniel also mentions that ADHD drugs carry stigma and regulation, that coffee doesn't. That's an asymmetry worth examining. Why is one stimulant a controlled substance and the other available in every gas station?
The regulatory distinction is largely historical and cultural, not pharmacological. Amphetamine and methylphenidate have higher abuse potential than caffeine. That's undeniable. They produce euphoria at high doses, particularly when administered intravenously or intranasally. Caffeine doesn't reliably produce euphoria, and its abuse potential is limited by its side effect profile. You'd be miserably jittery long before you reached a dose that could be considered recreational.
The abuse potential of therapeutic oral formulations is much lower. The slow onset of extended-release formulations limits the reinforcing effect. The brain associates the drug effect with the rapidity of onset. Swallow a pill, wait 45 minutes, and you don't get the same dopamine spike as snorting or injecting.
And that's part of the rationale behind lisdexamfetamine, the prodrug I mentioned. It's inactive until metabolized in the bloodstream, so even if someone tries to snort or inject it, it won't produce a rapid high. The formulation itself is a safety feature. Caffeine has no such built-in protection, though its intrinsic properties make it less abusable.
I think there's also a moral dimension to the stigma. Coffee is associated with industriousness and normal adult behavior. ADHD medication is associated with childhood behavioral problems and, unfairly, with cheating or enhancement. There's a sense that taking a pill to focus is somehow inauthentic, while drinking coffee to focus is just being a grown-up.
The authenticity argument is philosophically interesting, but medically nonsensical. If your brain has a neurochemical deficit, correcting it isn't cheating, it's treatment. The fact that coffee is culturally coded as authentic and methylphenidate as artificial doesn't change the underlying biology. It's a social construct layered on top of pharmacology.
Daniel's point about ADHD meds not lasting long enough and hitting too hard, that's something I want to circle back to. It sounds like his experience is with immediate release formulations, or maybe he hasn't found the right extended release option yet.
It could also be a metabolism issue. Some people are fast metabolizers of stimulant medications due to genetic variants in the CYP2D6 enzyme, which is involved in metabolizing many drugs, including amphetamine. Fast metabolizers clear the drug more quickly, so they experience a shorter duration of effect. Slow metabolizers may experience more side effects because the drug accumulates. Pharmacogenetic testing can sometimes help guide dosing, though it's not yet standard practice.
The hitting too hard sensation, that could be related to the rate of absorption. Even some extended release formulations have an initial immediate release component to get the plasma concentration up quickly. If that initial spike is too pronounced for a particular individual, it can feel jarring.
That's why there are so many different formulations on the market. Concerta uses an osmotic pump that releases methylphenidate in a gradually increasing pattern. Vyvanse uses the prodrug mechanism. Adderall XR uses coated beads with different dissolution rates. MyDaze uses a triple bead delivery system designed to last up to 16 hours. Each approach produces a different pharmacokinetic profile, and finding the right one is often a process of trial and error. It's not that the medications are inherently flawed, it's that individual variation is substantial.
Contrast that with coffee, where the pharmacokinetic customization is limited to choosing between light roast and dark roast. You can't precisely control the release profile of a cup of coffee.
You can't, and you're also dealing with the other compounds in coffee that have their own effects. Coffee contains over 1,000 chemical compounds. Some, like chlorogenic acid, may have beneficial antioxidant effects. Others, like the diterpenes I mentioned, can raise cholesterol. When you drink coffee, you're consuming a complex botanical extract, not a single molecule. Caffeine is the main psychoactive component, but it's not the only thing affecting your body.
Pharmaceutical preparations, by contrast, are a single molecule or a defined mixture of a few related molecules. The effects are more predictable because the input is simpler. That's what Daniel means by cleaner.
And cleaner doesn't mean side effect free. It means the side effects are more predictable and more directly attributable to the known mechanism. If methylphenidate gives you a headache, it's likely due to the vasoconstrictive effects of increased norepinephrine. If coffee gives you a headache, it could be the caffeine or the dehydration or something else in the brew or caffeine withdrawal from your last dose wearing off. The causal chain is murkier.
I think we should address the non-pharmacological aspect Daniel mentioned. He calls caffeine a non-pharmacological stimulant, which is an interesting framing. I think he means non-prescription, because caffeine is absolutely pharmacological. It's a drug.
It is a drug, and it's a drug with a well-characterized mechanism of action, a defined lethal dose, and a withdrawal syndrome. Calling it non-pharmacological is a category error, but I understand what Daniel means. He's drawing a distinction between something you buy at a pharmacy with a prescription and something you buy at a cafe. The distinction is regulatory and cultural, not scientific.
The lethal dose of caffeine is actually startlingly low compared to how casually we consume it. It's estimated at around 10 grams for an adult, about 100 cups of coffee consumed rapidly. There have been fatalities from caffeine pills and highly concentrated caffeine powders. It's a reminder that the dose makes the poison, and that natural doesn't mean safe.
Therapeutic doses of ADHD medication are far from the lethal dose. For methylphenidate, the therapeutic range is typically 10 to 60 milligrams per day. The lethal dose is orders of magnitude higher. The safety margin for prescribed stimulants, when used as directed, is actually quite wide. The risks that get attention are mostly related to misuse, diversion, or pre-existing cardiovascular conditions.
Let's talk about cardiovascular effects, since that's a concern for both caffeine and ADHD meds. Both increase heart rate and blood pressure to some degree. Is there a meaningful difference in the risk profile?
Both do increase sympathetic tone, and both can raise blood pressure and heart rate. For caffeine, the effect is primarily through adenosine blockade leading to increased catecholamine release. For stimulant medications, it's through direct enhancement of norepinephrine signaling. The magnitude is generally modest for both at typical doses. A analysis found that therapeutic doses of methylphenidate raise systolic blood pressure by about 2 to 4 millimeters of mercury on average. Caffeine at doses of 2 to 300 milligrams raises systolic blood pressure by about 5 to 10 millimeters of mercury acutely, though tolerance develops with regular use.
Caffeine actually has a more pronounced acute pressor effect in caffeine-naive individuals. The tolerance piece is interesting. Regular coffee drinkers don't show the same blood pressure spike because their adenosine system has adapted.
And with ADHD medications, the cardiovascular effects tend to be stable over time rather than diminishing. That's why guidelines recommend monitoring blood pressure and heart rate in patients on stimulant therapy. It's not that the risk is high, it's that it's worth keeping an eye on.
Daniel's description of ADHD meds as imperfect resonates with me. He's not saying they're a miracle. He's saying they're better than the alternative. That's a mature perspective that gets lost in a lot of the polarized discourse around ADHD treatment.
It's a harm reduction framework, essentially. Caffeine is the available harm reduction tool for someone without a diagnosis. It's better than nothing, but it comes with significant downsides. Prescription medication is a more effective harm reduction tool with a better side effect profile for most people. Neither is perfect, but one is clearly superior for the intended purpose.
That's the answer to the person who says, "Why don't you just drink coffee?" The answer is, coffee works, but it works badly. It's like using a wrench as a hammer. You can drive a nail with it, but you're going to damage the wrench and bend the nail. And there's a perfectly good hammer sitting on the shelf that you're not allowed to use without a prescription.
That analogy works. And the prescription requirement exists for legitimate reasons. These are drugs with abuse potential, and they need to be managed by a physician. But the barrier to access creates a situation where people spend years using the wrench, convincing themselves it's good enough, until they finally try the hammer and realize what they've been missing.
Daniel mentions that it took him a long time to relinquish the coffee habit and accept that ADHD medication is just better. I think part of that is identity. If you've been a coffee drinker for years, it's part of who you are. Giving it up feels like losing a piece of yourself, even if the replacement is objectively better.
The identity piece is real. Coffee culture is a thing. People identify as coffee snobs, they have pour-over setups, they debate roast profiles. There's no equivalent culture around ADHD medication. Nobody bonds over their preferred extended-release formulation. The social dimension of coffee consumption is a powerful reinforcer that medication can't replicate.
Which is fine, honestly. You don't need to give up coffee entirely when you start ADHD medication. Many people continue to drink coffee in moderation because they enjoy the ritual and the taste. The difference is that they're no longer depending on it as their primary cognitive support. The medication handles the heavy lifting, and the coffee is just a pleasant beverage.
That's an important point. It's not an either-or proposition. The question is, what's doing the therapeutic work? If the answer is the medication and the coffee is supplementary, that's a perfectly reasonable arrangement. The problem is when coffee is the only tool available and it's not adequate to the task.
Let's zoom out to the broader context. ADHD is underdiagnosed in adults, particularly in certain demographics. People who are high-functioning enough to get through school without being flagged often don't get diagnosed until their 30s or 40s, when the demands of work and family life exceed their coping capacity. During those undiagnosed decades, caffeine is often the unrecognized self-medication strategy.
It's not just caffeine. As I mentioned earlier, nicotine use is elevated in undiagnosed ADHD. There's also higher rates of cannabis use, which some people find helps with the restlessness and racing thoughts. The pattern is consistent. People are reaching for whatever neuroactive substance is available to manage symptoms they don't yet have a name for.
Once they get the name and the prescription, the whole framework shifts. The caffeine habit that seemed necessary suddenly looks like what it was, a workaround. Not a solution, but a coping mechanism with costs that were invisible because they'd been normalized.
That normalization is powerful. When everyone around you is also drinking coffee, the side effects don't register as side effects. The sleep disruption, the afternoon crash, the digestive issues, those are just part of being an adult. It's only when you experience an alternative that you realize those weren't inevitable.
I think that's the core of Daniel's question. He's asking us to articulate why the alternative is better, not just subjectively, but mechanistically. And the answer is clear. Caffeine is an adenosine antagonist with weak indirect dopaminergic effects and broad systemic side effects. ADHD medications are targeted dopamine and norepinephrine enhancers with more selective central effects and a more favorable therapeutic index. The difference isn't subtle, and it's not a matter of intensity. It's a difference in kind.
That difference in kind is why the little tablet can outperform liters of coffee. It's not about the dose, it's about the target. A small amount of the right molecule at the right receptor can do more than a large amount of the wrong molecule at the wrong receptor.
There's a neuroimaging study I want to mention. It looked at cerebral blood flow changes after methylphenidate administration and found increased perfusion in the prefrontal cortex and decreased perfusion in the striatum. The prefrontal increase correlates with improved executive function. Caffeine's effects on cerebral blood flow are more mixed. It generally reduces cerebral blood flow due to vasoconstriction, which is not necessarily beneficial for cognitive function.
Caffeine is a cerebral vasoconstrictor. It reduces blood flow to the brain by about 20 to 30% at typical doses. That's not inherently bad, the brain has plenty of reserve, but it's not doing your prefrontal cortex any favors. Methylphenidate, by contrast, seems to redistribute blood flow toward task-relevant regions. The effect is more nuanced than simple vasoconstriction.
We've got multiple levels of difference. Receptor target, anatomical specificity, side effect profile, pharmacokinetic predictability, cerebral blood flow effects, tolerance development. At every level, the prescription medication is a more precise intervention. Caffeine is a blunt instrument that happens to be widely available.
I don't want to come across as anti-coffee. I'm not. Coffee is a delightful beverage with a rich cultural history. The point is simply that it's not a treatment for ADHD, and expecting it to serve that function is a recipe for suboptimal outcomes.
Daniel's experience bears that out. He spent years trying to make coffee do a job it wasn't designed for, and when he finally switched to the tool that was designed for that job, it worked better. The skepticism he felt is understandable, but the pharmacology backs up his subjective experience.
And I think that's the message for anyone listening who's in the position Daniel was in before his diagnosis. If you're drinking large amounts of coffee just to function, and you suspect there might be something else going on, it's worth getting evaluated. The coffee might be doing more than you realize, not in a good way. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. It has been since the 12th century, when it was adopted as a symbol of purity and power in Scottish heraldry, predating the lion rampant by several hundred years.
Right. To wrap this up, the question Daniel posed was about the difference between caffeine and ADHD medication at the neurochemical level, and why the medication is cleaner despite its imperfections. The answer, in brief, is that caffeine blocks adenosine receptors everywhere, producing diffuse effects including jitters, gut issues, and sleep disruption, with only weak indirect dopamine enhancement. ADHD medications target dopamine and norepinephrine transporters directly in the brain circuits that need them. One is a shotgun, the other is a scalpel. The scalpel isn't perfect, but it's the right tool for the job.
For anyone who's been self-medicating with coffee and wondering if there's a better option, the evidence says yes. Not because coffee is bad, but because it was never designed to treat ADHD. It's a plant alkaloid that happened to become humanity's favorite stimulant. Prescription medications were designed, refined, and tested specifically for the neurochemistry of attention deficit. The difference shows.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you found this useful, share it with someone who's been staring at their coffee cup wondering the same thing. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.